From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a doctor's office where a woman named Shirley was receiving some devastating news. She has terminal lung cancer, and her doctor, Alap Patel, explains the diagnosis and tells her that the cancer has spread to her liver and her bones. Shirley tells her doctor that he's wrong, that she doesn't believe it. She quit smoking years ago. Patel calmly explains more about the disease, and slowly, Shirley comes to terms with her prognosis. It's a conversation that happens in doctors' offices every day in this country, but in this case, Shirley doesn't really have cancer. She's an actor, and her doctor is a student at the University of Rochester Medical Center. It's part of the standardized patient program at URMC, one of the few communication-based training programs for medical students in the country. It goes beyond the typical training about how to read charts and lab reports. The goal there is to help students learn how to better connect with patients on an emotional level and to provide care based on who patients are and what they want as they face some difficult news. In effect, it's an extension of a conversation that we've seen in a lot of different venues. Can we teach and grow empathy? This hour, we're going to talk about the program and if it can be taught. I'd like to welcome our guest for the hour. Dr. Rob Horowitz is back here, Chief of Palliative Care at the University of Rochester Medical Center, who first grabbed us and told us about this a few months back, and we knew we wanted to have this conversation because this only impacts everyone at some point, doesn't it, Dr. Horowitz?
Indeed it does.
Well, thanks for being back here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Marta Brewer. Marta is a long time and recently retired. So grab that microphone as I say congratulations, by the way. She's a standardized patient educator. Great to have you. Thanks for taking the time to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Nicole Rojas is here, a URMC graduate who is now a psychiatry resident at Yale. Dr. Rojas, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Hello to Julie Gissen, an actor in the standardized patient program. Julie, welcome to you.
Thank you. Welcome.
And Brett Dahlberg is a health reporter and producer for WXXI News. You heard his outstanding work on this subject earlier this week. First time in studio.
First time.
We'll see how it goes. This may be the last time. Thanks for being here. So, Brett, you had a chance to go out and witness this, what, just a few weeks ago now?
Yeah, I went at the end of June. It was the last day of the third year of medical school for the students that I saw at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
And Dr. Horowitz, why don't you give us just sort of a general comment about why this is happening now and the shape of it and sort of the goals of it, because this hour we get to get really in the weeds on how you try to teach empathy and how those moments can be so difficult and whether you can even approximate them. But why don't you start with just sort of the overview on what this program is?
Yes. So this is called the third year comprehensive assessment. And both second year and third year students have a comprehensive assessment at the end of those years. It's a 4-year program in medical school. And this is a week long evolving case in which every student meets with somebody like Shirley to get acquainted with her over the course of a week as her illness declares itself. So along the way, identifying what's going on, sharing bad news, negotiating a plan going forward. And these are complicated and essential skills for students to learn to become excellent clinicians.
And Brett, you got a chance to see this kind of process with the actors, with the students. And I admit that when Dr. Horowitz told me about it first off, I thought it's important. We're all going to be there ourselves or with loved ones, with parents, with siblings, and you want there to be an empathetic interaction. But can you really approximate it when you know it's an actor? And yet when I listen to your story, I'm going, boy, I'm really in this more than I thought I would be. How did you feel about it?
I wondered about that, too. I had some of the same sort of doubt or misgiving about whether this would seem contrived, whether it would seem like it was real. And then I was in the room, and Alap Patel, the student that I was watching, entered the room, had Shirley Brown there with her daughter, and suddenly it was very real. Alap was connecting with them about their interest in gardening. He was asking them about how everything was going. They were having what seemed to me, you know, to be a very real conversation about a very real hospital experience and a very real diagnosis. And it was easy to forget that none of this was real and it was all practice and the actors were in fact acting.
We've got three clips that Brett grabbed, and as we get ready to let you listen to those on the interactions there, if you've got to kind of either strain your ear or turn it up just a little bit, it's worth listening because you know you're in the room. This is the natural sound of what it actually sounds like. First clip kind of generally does what here, Brett?
Right. So in the first clip, we should also say I'm far away so that I'm not part of this interaction.
Sure.
I'm in the back of the room, and I'm watching Alat Patel, the medical student, tell Shirley Brown for the first time that she has lung cancer. And there's a long pause in the middle of this clip. It's long for radio. It's about 5 seconds. And that's important to know because the students that I talked to afterwards talked also about the value of silence in having these conversations and letting them flow. So Alap is going to tell Shirley Brown that she has lung cancer here.
All right, let's listen.
We'll start with the fluid that we took out from your lungs. So the fluid showed a certain type of cell called a small cell, kind of looks like a tiny blue cell on the microscope. And that's important for us to recognize because it's consistent with a diagnosis of small cell carcinoma, which is a type of lung cancer. It's a lot to take in.
Ooh. Okay, but it's small cell, so that's good news. It's not a large cell, so we can do something to get rid of it, correct?
I hear where you're coming from in that thought, but unfortunately it doesn't quite work like that. It's really just describing the type of cell that it is, not necessarily the intensity of the cancer per se.
Yeah, go ahead, Brad.
For me, sitting in that room, the silence was very real. I had no idea what was going to be on the other side of it. And it was also pretty clear that neither of the other people in that interaction did either.
Let's listen to the second clip in which Shirley Brown, again, who's an actor, but in this case receiving a diagnosis, doesn't really believe it, right, Brad?
That's right, yeah. The actors will respond in any way that a real person receiving the diagnosis might. They might act numb. They might have a hard time believing what's going on. They might challenge the person delivering the news. And so in this case, that's right, Shirley Brown has trouble believing what the diagnosis is.
All right, let's listen to that.
Those can't be mine. I gave up smoking cigarettes 2 years ago. I haven't really had any problems since then. And they said if you stop smoking, every day is better and better and better. I feel really good, especially now. I don't think that's right.
So that's her challenging the diagnosis, the denial that can be there, which we will talk about as we go throughout this hour. The last clip is Shirley Brown wondering about treatment options and the medical student, as is often the case, I mean, there's not always a perfect answer or all of the answers immediately in play here, right?
One of the things that we talked about, I and the students and Rob talked about, was the value of not knowing and in admitting or acknowledging that they don't know. And so this is Alap having to realize that he doesn't know all of the answers here and that the patient is going to ask some very real, very legitimate questions that he is going to have to figure out how to answer without knowing the answer.
All right, let's listen.
What's that going to add to my life if I do that?
That's a very good question. And I hope that our oncology team will be able to better guide those discussions with you.
You know, that's a very straightforward answer, and it can be, I'm sure it can be tough. We'll talk about it with Dr. Horowitz and our other guests coming up here. But I was really moved by this piece of reporting, Brett, because I think without hearing exactly what it sounds like, it's hard to kind of get inside that room and think, can you act this out? And I guess I'm just really impressed. It's not going to be perfect. No one's going to walk out of there with a perfect answer on what to say. I can't even imagine what I'd say in that moment, right? But some final thoughts from you before we cut you loose, because you got to get back to the newsroom right now.
There is news happening. It's an impressive feat to watch not only that one microcosm of these interactions, but the scale that this is happening at. I mean, it's an impressive operation. It's timed down to the minute. There's a control room where there are video screens showing what's happening throughout URMC, where a lot is one interaction, but many of those others are happening for many other students who are finishing up this comprehensive exam, and all of them are having to work through the same difficult interaction with the patient, and they get a chance to do it here before they have to actually have these interactions in real life. And so when they mess up, when they make a mistake, when Alap realized that he didn't have all the answers and that, you know, maybe he will in the future or he won't, and either way, you know, there's a chance for them to practice. And that's what I saw. I saw them practicing, but I also saw them doing the practice in a very real, very convincing, and very compelling way.
Great reporting on this. Thanks for coming in and sharing with us. And it's nice to have you in the studio here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Brett Dahlberg, WXXI health reporter and producer, whose work you'll hear on a regular basis here on WXXI. So, Dr. Horowitz, when you hear the clip there, do you, I'm not going to ask you to grade everybody involved, but I want to just generally know how you feel like they did.
Yeah, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that. Nobody's graded. Fair. Everyone passes just by virtue of showing up, and that's part of what makes this achievable. You'll hear from one of our students shortly about that. But we've essentially removed grades. There's no check boxes. The students are encouraged to be brave, to try things out that are real stretches for them, because no medical student actually delivers this bad news in reality, but they will be soon enough. So I hear this, and I hear great strengths, great skills on Alap's part, and I also hear opportunities for getting better. And that's what this is built for.
So, Alap, if you're listening, we are not here to criticize. Oh, in fact, I was very impressed. I thought,
yes,
Alap had a very human... To me, my favorite moment is when he is acknowledging, when she says, look, it's small cell, so we can do something. He says, I totally understand,
yep,
why you might think so.
Yep.
You know, instead of saying, wrong lady.
Right.
I mean, and I don't mean it quite that bluntly,
right,
but we've all been in situations where a doctor might seem to be a little heavy-handed.
Absolutely.
And I thought Alap was straightforward while still, yep, showing empathy there.
Yeah. And in response to your defending Alap, I want to make really clear, too, I encourage every one of the students, just as I do for myself, to look at every interaction with every patient and every colleague as a place where we demonstrate our strengths and a place where we can learn to grow. And so if anyone emerges from this experience thinking they have it all covered, they're doing everything perfectly, then I have failed them.
What did you hear in there that you thought, if you're just having a brief conversation with the Alap and he says, hey, give me a little guide point that I can improve upon?
Yeah. I'm going to put Alap on the spot. I didn't get his clearance to do that. I want to be cautious about that. But in sharing the discovery of lung cancer, there are various ways of doing so, let me suggest. So I can tell you this without specifically calling him out.
Sure.
That when I demonstrate this at the large group debrief, I show very direct ways of doing so, which are startling to some and upsetting to some, and very indirect ways of doing so as well. And depending on the patient's need, and I wasn't witness to this particular one that Brett recorded, there are often clues in the patient's eyes if the way that the information is being shared is the way they are willing to hear it or not. And so often there's an opportunity to ask the patient about, are you ready to hear the information, and how do you like to hear the information? Do you like it straight? Do you like a little bit at a time? This is about engaging the patient in the conversation, including in the information sharing itself.
So if someone walks into your office and says, just be blunt with me, do I have cancer?
Yeah.
What stage is it?
Yeah.
You feel that is a moment to be a little bit more direct, a little
absolutely
less,
yeah, for sure. And many patients will say, just lay it on, don't sugarcoat, doc. And that's an opportunity to say, you have widespread, incurable, metastatic, meaning widespread lung cancer.
And then
let it sit.
But then inevitably, there are many questions, which I thought the actor playing, I thought Shirley did an excellent job, at least helping us see the kinds of questions that are going to come up here.
Right.
How long do I have?
Right.
What are the treatment options there?
Right.
And so, but I think at the core of this is a question of whether you can teach empathy. Can you teach it?
Yes.
Just straight out, yes.
I'm convinced, yes.
Because some people are probably born more with it than others.
Yeah. I'm happy to talk further about that. I won't want to take up too much of your time around this thing, but we all have a sense of those people we know, and those of us in this room here have this empathic endowment. People who we know we can connect with easily and the others that we can't. That alone doesn't make for a skillful clinician communicator. There are observable, measurable behavioral skills that comprise sharing that empathic and compassionate connection.
But if I brought somebody to you who I've known for a long time, who I think this person has the social skills of an anvil, you can work on some empathetic approach with them? You think so?
Well, I'm not sure the anvil, but certainly people who don't have this inherent, obvious sort of empathic endowment can learn to do this well. One of the sort of icons in palliative care communication, a guy named Robert Buckman, he famously spoke in front of a crowd I was witness to talking about teaching communication skills, and he confessed, "I am Aspergoid," he said, meaning I, Robert Buckman, don't have this natural endowment. I don't pick up on emotional cues well, and yet I have learned to do it well, and I can teach anyone to do it well. I think that's true.
Marno, what have you seen with this kind of a program? What are some of the results that you feel like are at least really measurable? Is the wrong word. You can't really measure empathy, and everybody reacts to every moment and different situation differently. But what are some of the results you've seen? And do me a favor, get right on that microphone for you there.
I've seen the world become a little kinder place in small little bits and pieces. So perhaps there's a student that's not naturally empathic, but then you get somebody like Julie portraying the role in a kind manner, telling them, what do you think worked well? What do you think you could improve upon? And telling them, and you see that connection made. And then, since it's a week-long encounter, sometimes you watch these students during the week, and they really listen and they grow. And so, yes, you're going to have your natural empaths and you're not, but I've seen that everybody can improve to a certain extent.
Julie, as an actor in the standardized patient program, you want everybody, every student in that situation to be challenged in a way that is at least pretty realistic that they could face later. Do you go in with any sort of a game plan on how you are going to emote in those moments?
Not usually, no. I read the role so I know the patient that I'm playing, I know the backstory. And then I just go in and kind of trust that it's going to unfold in a real way if I don't have an agenda. I let the student ask and start the way they would start, and I just, it unfolds. I can do the same encounter 10 times in a day, and every one of them can be very different. Even though my story is the same story, it really depends what the student brings to it.
Do you try to get inside the mind of someone who might be in that situation as best you can?
It's hard. Absolutely.
I mean, it's hard to do that, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Particularly with the bad news. I mean, occasionally I'm just pretending I have a bad back, and that doesn't require this. But I'm not ready to leave, and so I just imagine what it would feel like to be told that my days are numbered, even though, of course, we all know that our days are numbered. I imagine what it would be like to be told right now that, you know, in this particular scenario, it's lung cancer, but whatever the story is. That
is there any type of emotional response that you have found students struggle with more, whether it's anger or really powerful sadness or silence? Is there anything that trips them up more often?
Crying. Crying is the thing that's the hardest for most of them. Many of them come in, and later on when we talk about it, they'll say, I just didn't want you to cry, you know. and then they'll say, I didn't want myself to cry. I was really afraid when I came in the room that I was going to break down and cry. And so, you know, that gives them the opportunity to play in that arena of, is it okay? And can you cry a little bit with a patient, or can your eyes water up with a patient? And look, that was okay. And actually the patient connected with you.
Dr. Horowitz?
Yeah, I want to name the courage and generosity of Julie and Marta and others who take on these roles, who are willing, because they're capable of doing so, of embodying a great grief. And you have shared with me, Julie, that you, in anticipation of doing this role, picture your family, picture being really given a diagnosis, and your tears and your emotion are real, and you share those for hours at a time, day after day. And it's a remarkable opportunity for students who are aware of the conceit, the pretense around this thing, that they are really in the midst of a real human being with real tears, even though the story is conjured in some way.
Is it okay to cry as a doctor?
Oh, goodness, yes. But not every student experiences the crying the same way, and neither is it a mandate to do so.
That's a great point. So let's find out what it was like for Dr. Rojas. Nicole, you did this, you went through this kind of training, what, 3 years ago now?
Yes, I did.
What do you remember about that?
I remember crying. And I remember this was a pivotal moment in my training, because in being authentic and vulnerable in that space, I remembered why I chose medicine, to have that honor and privilege to see someone's humanity, have them see mine, and remember how precious life is and how valuable it is, how to live well, and when faced with our mortality, how to honor it with grace and sit with what is.
When you went in for those conversations, how many different conversations did you end up doing?
Oh, I'm not sure. A handful. I know I remember coming tired after each day, and I think there was two. Was it a week? 2 weeks?
So this particular one with Julie was one time out of 5 days of successive visits, and then this third year, that was during second year. Mm-hmm. This third year one is a succession of 4 days of very intense conversations.
Were you fearful at all? Like, were you nervous?
Oh, yes. Very nervous. I think, you know, I feel strange having you call me Dr. Hoss, because I just graduated in May. And as a student, as a doctor now, I just want to do this right, you know? And having this brave space to practice and to try, so that in the moment when and now that I have actually had to have these conversations as the doctor, that I could feel like I was doing right by them, and I was honoring that moment.
What do you, Dr. Rojas, and I'll ask Dr. Horowitz, really every one of our panelists, what might you say to a dissenter to the notion of tears on the doctor's part, saying you have to hold it together because they're going to be experiencing intense emotion, but they want to look to you for strength? What would you say to someone who's dissenting to the idea that you ought to be able to cry if it's natural to you?
Yes, and I've struggled with that. Sometimes that voice has been my own. Like, your patients want you to have it together, to have all of the answers. And with that, I try to meet my voice with compassion, or the dissenters' voices with compassion, and to just be like, to cry doesn't mean that I'm a mess or I'm broken or things are going to fall apart. It's just to... the tears sort of speak like, I'm with you and I feel for you as a fellow human. I'm not going to cry more than the patient and not have them tend to me. But I can say, yeah, I see you and I'm with you in this suffering and you are not alone. And I found that my patients now respect me for that accompaniment, that alliance, that I'm with you on this. And this isn't just a job for me. I recognize this is your life and I'm going to show up for you.
Okay, Dr. Horowitz, what might you say to the dissenters?
Yeah, I don't know how to say better than that. Nicole and I have engaged in conversation about this quite a lot. So in my group of 104 students any given year, there will be some who cried and were grateful for that because it was validated and it validates their humanity and the patient received it well. There are others who come away ashamed that they cried and thinking they can't manage emotion well. And so my message is we as clinicians are not simply indifferent technicians. We are fellow humans. We are fellow mortals. We know grief, and we feel affection for our patients. And our sadness, I have never in my decades of being a physician, I've never seen my tears, my sadness being rejected. it has always brought closer the relationship with those that I'm tending to. And they've always thanked me for my warmth in my heart when I shed a tear because of their grief. This is, in fact, Evan, this is empathy alive. And again, it's not mandate. Not everyone does this. And I'm not suggesting everyone should. But if that happens, if that arises naturally, that's part of what this relationship then becomes about. And that's okay.
Julie, Marta, what is it like being there on the role of an actor in that situation, helping students prepare, and all of a sudden your tears are met with their tears? Does that change how you feel? Because again, I mean, Julie, you said you're trying to embody that feeling as best you can. How does that impact you emotionally?
It feels wonderful from a professional perspective because I feel like I'm doing my job. You know, you're not going to sit down and tell me bad news and be close to crying yourself unless I've done something that has made it feel real. And that's what I'm supposed to do. So I feel happy I've done the right thing. But I also feel like just on a human level, I feel like jumping up and down and, you know, woohooing because I'm really happy that this person sitting here is somebody who wants to really feel what their patient is feeling, who wants to show that they care. And I know no matter what they do out in the world with their patients, as long as they can bring actual caring into the room, then, you know, their patients are going to be in good hands.
Hmm. Marta?
I think that if somebody cries with me, then I feel like they've connected and it feels nice. It feels like they care. You know, it's a professional. You know that they have 15 minutes with you in the doctor's office or whatever. But if... I'm sure that you have the same thing. If you connect with someone, here I am looking at you, even though you're on the radio and you're in this big room, but it feels nice. By the same token, I don't think that people should think, oh, now we all have to cry to be empaths. Not at all. You have to be human, because if you're hypocritical or I can cry on a dime and you don't really feel it, then it doesn't feel real. And then it feels kind of fake and phony.
Well, I'm a crier. I'm pro-crying. I think experiencing real human emotions across the spectrum is powerful and important. And so people who know me know that about me. But I have, it's interesting, Dr. Horowitz, on this program, I have accidentally sort of like let it go a little bit just a couple of times. And I will say that I felt embarrassed is the wrong word. I was worried that my emotional reaction would center me in a conversation that wasn't about me.
Right.
And I wonder, as a doctor, if there is a concern about that, that this is about the patient.
Sure, sure. It is. It's also about the relationship. And so I hear that all the time. I hear the refrain, this is not about us, the clinician. And so I respond to that quite stridently and say it has to be about us to some extent. In order for this work, in order for me to do this well, room after room, patient after patient over the course of decades, I need to take care of myself. And part of taking care of myself is being authentic and being real. And so while I'm not looking to be supported by the patient, if this incredibly unequal relationship is leveled just a little bit by the fact that I am now feeling emotion and the patient who is in grief reaches out to me with a hand, which has happened before, there's a little bit of leveling. We're still, even though we're equal as humans, we're still in a very unequal position there. And I see that as an opportunity for the patient to give a little bit back. That's not been a bad thing. And I think most of my colleagues who have experienced this before would say the same, and the patients as well.
All right, listeners, I'm going to appeal to you to share with us, have you had difficult conversations, maybe for yourself, maybe for a loved one, a parent, a spouse, a sibling, a friend, where you were either deeply moved and touched by the empathy on display from medical staff, or were you disappointed? What can we do better? What can the industry do better that is serving us and that is helping us deal with some very difficult parts of our lives? It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. After our only break of the hour, we're going to take some of your feedback. By the way, you can email us, connections@wxxi.org. And we're going to talk about strategies for breaking bad news as well. Some questions that, you know, is there sort of a set list that doctors will ask? Because Dr. Horowitz let us in on the idea that they are going to try to assess our preference for a communication style, that it's not one size fits all. But is there sort of a roster of questions that we should be prepared for or that we should be thinking about too? So a short break and we come right back talking about this right here in Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, investigative journalist David K. Johnston joins us first hour. He wrote a piece for The New York Times laying out the legal case for seeing the president's tax returns. We'll talk to him about the progress there. In the second hour, our Summer of Food takes a look at food culture and what anthropologists can learn about an entire group of people from their food choices. Talk with you Thursday. Well, the phone is ringing now, and before we get to your calls and your experiences, I want to remind you why we are here this hour. We're talking about the standardized patient program, and we're talking about the way our doctors communicate with us, especially when there is news that is going to be hard to hear. Cancer-related diagnoses that we'll talk about end of life, and it can be very difficult. And Dr. Rob Horowitz says we can teach empathy, and they are doing that through this program. There are actors who play the role of a patient who has to receive some news that can be difficult, and they may challenge, and they do challenge, the medical students to respond either with information or sort of dealing with denial or anger or sadness. And it is a remarkable program that is obviously already producing results. So we're going to get to your phone calls in a moment, and we already have a bunch. I asked one time, and I think a lot of our listeners feel very strongly about this, which is just an indication that there's a lot of work to do. Dr. Rob Horowitz is Chief of Palliative Care at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Marta Brewer is a standardized patient educator. And Julie Gissen is an actor in the standardized patient program. Dr. Nicole Rojas is a recent graduate, now a psychiatry resident at Yale, who went through this program. Before those phone calls, Dr. Horowitz, I think you told our colleague Brett Dahlberg during his reporting for this story here on WXXI that this is a part of medical training that is still undertaught, would you say?
Yeah, I actually, in response to your introduction, yeah. This sort of thing, using standardized patients, is common across medical schools in the country. The particular thing we're doing, I don't know of any survey that declares, we think this particular program we're doing is relatively unique. And this is a relatively rare focus of standardized patient interaction.
Okay. And do you think the question on the old term bedside manner, the question on that, is that under focused in training?
I think it's ever more a focus of training. I know certainly in Rochester from really day one, there are opportunities to practice bedside manner, talking about responding to emotion and such. So there's ever more of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, let's listen to what some of our listeners want to share about this. We'll start in Webster with Polly. Go ahead, Polly.
Hi, Evan. I was just calling because in February, I was diagnosed with cancer, and I had to go to some of my other medical doctors after the diagnosis, and just how much they reached out to me, and the love and the hugs and just the support that I received from them. And I just wanted to say, you know, that I really appreciated it. Mm.
Polly, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I went through 28 treatments of radiation, and we're just, you know, waiting now for, I had endometrium cancer, so I will be going every 3 months for pap smear test, but right now I feel good, and so we're real positive, so.
I would say, Marta, that's a pretty good endorsement of just the power of empathy and the way relationships and those emotional connections can really matter.
Yeah, I think that you remember how people treat you. You don't remember exactly what they said, but it's that feeling. And we're all going to have to live through a lot of sort of not nice things, mostly in our life. And if you could just do it with a kind touch or a nice touch, it just makes the world a good place.
Polly, good luck to you, and thank you for sharing just that story with us here. I know it can be difficult, but thank you very much, Polly.
Thank you.
Let me turn to Colin and Victor next on the phone. Go ahead, Colin.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just calling to support the power of empathy in the midst of people's most broken moments. I'm a pastor out in the Victor area and also one of the volunteer chaplains with the Ontario County Sheriff's Department. So there are occasions when you come to somebody at what is going to, at that point, be the worst moment in their lives. And the ability of somebody to empathize while also holding steady themselves creates this wonderful anchor point for people to not have their chaos define all of their future. And I've seen medical staff, for good or less, do that really well. And when it's done really well, it lets the moment be a moment instead of a thing that feels like forever.
Hmm. Colin, that's a powerful thought there. You want to add to that, our guest there? Julie, you look, you've got a strong reaction to that.
I mean, I'm just, that's kind of what I try to imagine when, like, when Dr. Horowitz and I role play that he's telling me something terrible is, you know, it's not my story today, but it's somebody's story. And that's what he's describing, is that people, there are people who are helpers who come to, who cross paths with others when they're at their most horrific, awful moments. And, you know, as Marta said, you remember the way people made you feel. And if you feel that you were really cared about in that moment, it can make all the difference. And instead of remembering something as having been super traumatic, it can also have elements of healing and love.
Colin, can I ask you one more question before I let you go?
Sure.
You know, I think about the ways that, and this may be, I may be overgeneralizing, but I think as a pastor yourself, I think people in the religious community are pretty comfortable putting their hands on others' hands or shoulders or making a physical contact during a difficult moment. And I think there's some real power there. And in a moment, I'll ask our guests in studio if they think that that's appropriate in those difficult moments when it's doctor and patient. But I even think about the interactions we have with people who are homeless. And when my six-year-old son notices someone and we want to stop and say hello or offer something, or if he has a sandwich that he wants to give someone. But I always tell him, we have to get out of the car. We're going to say hello. We're going to offer a hug. We're going to make contact. And we don't want people to feel like they're not touchable, like that there's a barrier between us. And I wonder how you feel about that, Colin.
Sure. So there's a couple pieces about that. Absolutely, yes. Physical contact does something in the interaction that nothing else can do, and usually for the better. The other piece is also to always ask permission.
Yeah.
So that it's not initiated unwanted, but it is asked. And I can tell you it easily 9 times out of 10, if I say, you know, may I take your hand, or can I give you a hug, or is it all right now if I put a hand on your shoulder, people just burst into tears and say yes. And it becomes a much deeper, real connection, because what's happening then between the two people is human to human, not diagnosis to recipient of information.
Great stuff, Colin. Thank you. I've never had someone, I asked the same question, can I give you a hug? I've never had someone say, no, I'm good. Usually it's yes, and often it's yes with enthusiasm.
I should share that I'm ever learning, I need to tell you. So I'm into the not knowing part of things. And in this last iteration of the comprehensive assessment, Julie and I had some discussion because I went into a room of students to talk about touch. And as I entered that room, I put my hand on the shoulder of one of the students who pulled her shoulder away and said, I didn't give you permission to do that. And that opened up a great conversation, because I am free with touch, and I sometimes assume that this is appropriate, and it is not. Colin, you say 9 times out of 10. I think that's probably about right. 1 time out of 10, that might not be accepted, and I do need to ask for consent before proceeding. So that's something I have learned, you know, particularly this day and age. We need to be conscious of that, to be human, and to ask permission.
Dr. Rojas, what's your approach with that?
I am still figuring it out, and I like what Pastor Colin said, asking permission, especially thinking about the Me Too movement and that being in my core. And also as a psychiatrist, too, I have tended to offer support. And some of the training that I've had now is to hold and ask first, and in that way share that power and honor the agency that's in the patient in front of me, whether this is appropriate or would be healing for them or triggering.
Mm-hmm. Pastor, thank you. Really beautiful stuff. Back to the phones we go. Marilyn in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Yes. I'm afraid that I had a very different reaction to the role play from what the rest of you had. I found two things that just really upset me. One was that I felt that the doctor spoke, the student spoke to the patient, used an awful lot of technical medical language and jargon, and it wasn't necessarily clear to me what he was saying. And I think that he was trying to sort of dance around it and not come out and say really what was happening. That was one thing that I thought the use of all that technical jargon was completely inappropriate unless you're talking to another medical person. The other thing is that I thought his voice was flat and unaffected, and I didn't hear any empathy whatsoever. Mm. It was almost as if he was reading the telephone book, and that while he was doing things like asking personal questions about her garden and everything like that, that he was checking off a list. Well, I have to spend 30 seconds asking some personal questions, and then I have to do this, and then I have to do that. I think if that had been me in a real situation and he had acted that way to me, I would have left in tears, not so much because of the diagnosis, but because of what I felt was cold, unaffected presentation.
All right, Marilyn, thank you. I mean, everybody's going to respond differently, and this is a good moment to remind, I'm sure our guests are going to have a lot to say to Marilyn's call, because I took that interaction very differently. I was impressed, and I will say, Marilyn, the reason that I was impressed was you heard a lot of medical jargon. I heard just enough to say, I respect you to want to explain what's going on without drowning you in jargon, and then here's what exactly that means. But that can be so delicate. Some people want all of the technical stuff. Some people want none of it. And I heard someone, I think, who was probably nervous, working really hard. But everyone's different, so this is a good moment to say, and Julie, everyone's going to take it slightly differently.
Yeah, so in doing these encounters, they're all different, but one thing that we couldn't see today, because we're on the radio, is that this is two people sitting together, presumably making eye contact. Body language wasn't anything that we could observe. But often with the students, I'm seeing body language and just a facial expression. I'm looking at the faces in this room. Everyone is conveying, caring and love. But when we sit down with the students afterwards and give feedback, if I felt there was jargon, that would be something that I would share, and we could brainstorm things that might have been easier for me to understand or hear, or what type of language I would have preferred. If I felt that the student spoke to me in a way that sounded like they didn't really care, they didn't have an empathetic tone in their voice, that might be something I would share in feedback, and we could talk about ways that could be different that would have worked for me. And the students are, across the board, very receptive to all that feedback.
Marta, what do you make of Marilyn's call there?
I think that certain people connect better with other people just on an inherent nature. And Marilyn, perhaps you would not have connected with him. I actually happened to watch this encounter. I wasn't yet retired then. And so, as to Julie, is that there was a lot of people were together, were close to that. And so I think that if you see it and if you're in it, you might have had a different reaction, or you might have had the same reaction you're going to have. And so if you have a reaction when you're a patient, and if somebody uses medical jargon that you don't understand, you say, just a moment, could you please explain it in layman's term? Or what do you mean by this? What do you mean by that? Because if students do use jargon, then you could feel stupid. Do you ask a question or not? But I didn't quite get it that same way. But I respect that you did.
Okay. Rob, go ahead.
And just you were asking earlier, again, in terms of jargon, so this in a way was built in as a setup. It's interesting that this Shirley Brown responded to a comment about small cells with, oh, therefore it's not a big deal. So she was in a way prepped for jargon. That was jargon. He responded beautifully to it. It's a common common way of sharing information. And for even that, Shirley, to be honest, Marilyn is picking up on it was too much for her. She wasn't able to get to the root until he said so.
Correct.
He responded beautifully to that. So there was a great strength in response to a modest use of jargon that Marilyn's sensitive to, and others would be as well.
Okay. Dr. Rojas?
And just to add and echo what everybody else has said, I think we're seeing this clip after he's already introduced himself and set up that tone, so we don't know how he he and Shirley set up their relationship. And I think that's so important because I can respect how, you know, we patients and doctors, there's this power dynamic, and it and for some they might not necessarily think it's okay for me to ask if I don't understand, but I believe, based on what I heard in that encounter with Olive, like, that he would, in the setting and in the meeting, to invite that feedback. Like, if this was too much, we can turn it up or turn it down. And I think, as a student, what I love about this space is perhaps he was taking a risk. And in this encounter, I'm going to try to use more jargon and see how that feels. And perhaps in another encounter, he could try to, how does it feel if I just use all layman's terms? Trying to balance the language of medicine and the language of, like, every day.
Sure. Dr. Horowitz, is there a default idea about how much jargon is too much? Or how quickly you get to the main diagnosis?
This too is going to vary. I think, though, the general leaning among most who teach communication is to be direct. We heard terms about being, I don't remember what you said earlier, Evan, about being overly blunt, perhaps, or dancing. Neither of those is to be recommended. But being direct, using terminology that's understood, getting to the point is a general sort of middle way approach, and then adapting, as Nicole and others were saying, to the patient's response or their stated wishes.
Dr. Atul Gawande has written about this and wrote for by the way, Atul Gawande is among many other things, the founder of the Massachusetts Coalition for Serious Illness Care, has written for The New Yorker and many other publications. And he says, to ascertain what will bring well-being, he tells students to ask a sort of a set of questions. And I'm curious to know what our guests think of this. He says the questions he brings to mind are, what is your understanding of your illness? What are your fears and worries for the future? What are your priorities if time becomes short? What are you willing to sacrifice, and what are you not willing to sacrifice? What does a good day look like? How do those work for you, Dr. Horowitz?
Those work fine. There are multiple rubrics like that that have in common assuring that there is some mutual understanding of what's going on medically, and then in that context, exploring the patient's values, and then from that, deriving a treatment plan going forward. So he's covering those steps, I think, beautifully.
I think the question of what is your understanding on the medical side, and I especially want to hear from Marta and Julie, who've been on sort of the receiving end in an acting scenario, but I would think the last thing you'd want to do is leave a medical setting having had an interaction where you have more optimism that is merited because the doctor giving the news was trying so hard not to upset you that they might have allowed for more hope or optimism. That's sort of delicate, I'm sure. But Marta, what are your thoughts on that? Because everyone wants hope. You don't want to take hope away from people, but you also want realism.
I think that you do want realism. You do want hope. But I think that no matter what happens, if you're getting really bad news today, you're going to be in shock. And so I would think if I were the clinician, now I'm not a clinician, so I don't pretend to be a clinician, is that you read your patient. And they're not going to know. Some patients might want to know, okay, tell me, you know, what percentage of these live 50 million years out of here? Some will not. You read your patient. You give them bits of information in small little chunk, ask, tell, ask permission to do. And then you give them, I would like as a patient, a phone number, a contact, a follow-up, because I'll leave the appointment and what they say, I'm going to die. When? I don't know. So I would like that later, because I think in times of shock, everyone responds differently. And so who cares if the patient doesn't know this right now? You know, I mean, they need to know what's going on, but if they don't know the exact everything, this is just the first time you're breaking the bad news. So I don't think I would push it. I would want my clinician to push it on me.
Okay.
If I wasn't ready.
Julie?
I've had many students who have really been uncomfortable having to give bad news and realizing that they can't make it better, and they can't say, they can't think of anything on the spot to say that sounds better. Like once I was given a diagnosis of HIV positive, and the student, it was a small group classroom, the student kept timing out because I was crying and talking about my daughter and would I live to, you know, take care of her, would I see her grow up, and he wanted to tell me everything was going to be okay, and he didn't have enough information to give me any sort of confidence in that. So he kept timing out and going to his class and saying, oh my God, I don't know what to do. I feel so bad. She feels awful. And I thought this would be really easy because it's pretend, but I just want to tell her she's going to be okay. And I can't do that. And, you know, that's an example of a time when they want to do that. I also have had times where I can tell that the student is sugarcoating or using gentle language like, this looks like it may be small cell, instead of saying it is. And whenever I see that, because I know that they need to be able to give the diagnosis and they're scared to do it, I, as the patient, pretend that I latch onto that hope and say, oh, so it isn't definitely,
or
so it might
not
be.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, I latch onto that pretty desperately because I think a real person would, a real patient would look for any
Absolutely.
Bit of maybe not.
Final 20 seconds or so, Dr. Horowitz, for our listeners who want to know, if I don't like the interaction, it's always good to let people know, how do you handle if you think the interaction did not go well and about your expectations as a patient?
How do you as a patient respond?
As a patient.
The power differential that Nicole's saying, it is potent and it's not easy to do. And yet my invitation is to call it out and to call me out when I do wrong. I've been called out and it's humbling and it's important. I've gotten better because of it.
Really powerful stuff. I want to thank Dr. Rob Horowitz for coming in and telling us about this program and for pushing us to have this conversation because it's so useful. I mean, it's all of us at some point in our lives or in loved ones' lives. He's Chief of Palliative Care at URMC. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Dr. Rojas, good luck to you, a psychiatry resident at Yale. We've had multiple people in this building say, I wish you were my doctor.
Thank you for having me.
You're going to be outstanding. Thank you very much for being here. Julie Gissen and Marta Brewer, thank you for the insight you bring to this and for what you do as well. Thank you so much.
It was delightful. Thanks.
All right. Our thanks to Brett Dahlberg as well, our reporter at WXXI on health, and Rob Braden, Megan Mack behind the glass. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you tomorrow.